we're rolling?
No, the serious side of Paris is that the other side of the coin, you know, one side you have a picture of a buffalo head Indian, the other side is a picture of Montecito, the treasury, which is, that's serious, right? You know, public building. But there are crypto symbological things in the lyrics which deliberately have been put in there for those who would delve into them. But it's like the laughing Buddha and the frowning Buddha. It's both the same. And I can't abide too much seriousness at one place, nor can, you know, it gets a little draggy, too, if it's nothing but the other thing, too. So it's both, whatever anybody wants. I mean, it can be hard, ugly rock if somebody wants it to be that. And also, there's a few delicacies in there because you like to get into that, too. But the base of the pyramid of the thing that we want to do would just be energy. It's just fun to go out and sweat. And then except for the fact that, you know, I do not want to sing about, we don't want to play about trucking down to Mobile with my shotgun in my hand, you know, going to see my baby because I got my mojo hand. I'm going to put it on her in the right place. That type of thing, you know, why sing about that? I've never been to Mobile. You know, I was born in West Los Angeles, and then, you know, I don't relate to that. So people tend to think that hard rock has to be screaming and yelling about very basic things. Well, what we're doing was just screaming and yelling about complex things, which is no new thing, but that's so it turns out to be fun, you know. And hopefully there'll be a little melodic content here and there. There'll be a little camp of content here and there, whatever you want to think of as camp. I mean, it's getting so short. The space between what's camp and what's real these days is about, you know, what was happening last week is camp this week. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. It used to be a period of time is so people now it's getting to the point where you camp yourself. You know, what you did yesterday is camp today. You know what I mean? It's weird. So that's going to put a lot of satirists out of business. Satirists. A lot of satyrs. But I don't know. What are we all looking for anyway? I mean, the nugget is not there. The nugget is, I mean, it's definitely not coming from Xerox. It's not coming from TRW. For sure it's not coming from General Motors or any of those people. The nugget, everybody's looking for the nugget. So it's either entertainment, or perhaps there can, if it's entertainment first, as far as the rock and roll business goes, then maybe there will be on the periphery, if you care to glean anything, it will be little things where if you can communicate with one person in the audience, like tongue-in-cheek, they know what you mean, and you know what they mean, that's good enough. And the rest of the people who have a good time, get sweaty, put their hand on their girlfriend's knee, you know, which everybody has always done in the past. And always will do. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Was this sounding too crazy?
Or too, sounds pretty logical.
Too disjointed?
What about some of the lyrics of your
pardon
songs?
Pardon?
Some of the lyrics of your songs.
Well, that's kind of what I mean. But
you write about religion?
Well, I cannot give an exegesis, as they used to say.
That's a good word.
Remember that word? Before, when people used to go to school because they thought they would... you know, because there were, you know, IBM set up recruiting centers on the campus. I remember, to set up so you can make $20,000 a year if you promise, put your name in this line. You promise when you graduate, you'll sign with us. They used to do that.
Oh yeah, I've heard
they don't do that anymore. I know guys who have 3 doctorates who are like pumping Texaco. You know, who cares? I mean, you don't need any more molecular biologists. What we need is some people to shovel up the what's laying in the street. You know, it's a shame. But what am I? Let's see. Where were we? The lyrics. Now they said I cannot sing about something that I can't feel that I can sing about, because as I said before, if I sing about trucking down the Mobile, we're gonna boogie tonight. Well, even though I might like to boogie, whatever that means, I can't sing about that. I'll burst into laughter, you know. So I have to sing about stuff that I'm interested in, and I also like the idea of not being too direct. I mean, the old thing about political messages about, you know, we got to have freedom and burn the thing down. You can't do that. That's not subtle enough lyrically for me. I like to sing words that convey nice images, that sound nice to the mouth, that feels good for my throat to put out, you know. And I like to make up almost like little anagrams and little cryptic things that if certain people want to explore them further, they do have certain literary and other antecedents there. But I mean, I wouldn't say that to anybody who's just a hard rock freak, because they're not to know. You know, who cares? Do you know what I mean? It's like the old the Zen master thing of the karate guy. He says, "What is the meaning of life?" And the guy goes, "You know what I mean." Hits him in the face. I'll do it again. You know? Don't, you know, shut up. That's what they do. So, whatever, that's, I put in it what I put in it, but I'm not going to go around explaining and having a messianic complex about anything, because too many people already are doing that. Who tried to do that recently and didn't get away with it? Bowie kind of gets into some of those things, but people can take it or leave it, you know. He's on the frontiers of something. Although, I think he's grabbed a hold of the wrong handle. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Golden years and all that. Anyway, we do one thing on stage, which has nothing to do with anything I've written, but we do, you know the thing?
Yeah.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss, man.
Right.
A sigh is still a sigh. The real thing goes, no matter what the future brings, as time goes by. And then, slap in the face, that's it. You know what I mean?
Right.
What else can you say about anything?
What a day this has been.
Yeah, we can do that one. What a day this has been. I love the whole world I'm in. Well, it's almost like being in love. Dig this. Got a smile on my face.
For the whole human race.
In the coda. Well, it's almost like being. Yes, it's almost like being. Well, it's almost like being in love. Ow! Thank you, Gene Krupa. You know, what can I say?
You do that on stage?
Occasionally.
In and out, yeah.
Anything's bound to happen at a show. It's never the same.
You know, I mean, those moods are just as good as whatever, rock and roll, hoochie-coo. I mean, what the hell is that? You know? What's hoochie-coo anyway?
It's whatever.
You know, there was hoochie-coo in 1918. There was hoochie-coo in 1376, only they called it, you know what I mean? They had fancy scripts then, but it was the same bit. You know? So, just, ask me something, or ask one of us something. I've kind of been talking a little too much here.
Let's talk to Glenn a little bit.
All right. What do you want to talk about?
What were you doing before you got together with Paris?
Well, I was living in West Berlin, because I got very sick of living in London. Got to be a very boring place, London, so I thought, well, where can I go?
This after you'd split Wild Turkey?
Yeah. I was a bit depressed about that, but I thought, all right, where can I go? So I contacted everybody that I knew in the music business outside of England. Just wrote to everybody blindly. Said, listen, what's going on? Any bands I can join, anything I can do. I got a letter from West Berlin within about 3 days. And they said, oh, there's a great band over here. How do you like to come and join them? So I went and joined them. Never even heard them or anything.
Yeah.
I just got to that point when I had to go somewhere different and try something else. And I stayed there for about 8 or 9 months. And it was a real nice break. Sometimes you just need a change of air, almost. And West Berlin is such a freaky place to live that I really enjoyed it. You know, driving through East Germany every time you had to go out somewhere, and you know, living right by the Berlin Wall and going into East Berlin and seeing all the 16-year-old soldiers with machine rifles. You know, it's it gives you a slightly different attitude towards things. Yeah, I had a great time there, and then Bob called me and said, "I'm getting something together in L.A." And I thought, L.A., sunshine, America. I like America anyway. So that was it. That was it for Berlin. Short but sweet, 8 to 9 months
there. The album said, what if he said goodbye, but what was it? Goodbye Berlin, remember that album?
Oh, yeah.
Farewell, what was it?
I Reaper really don't Bond. Remember. Oh, no, the Reaper Bond
take
is
off
Hamburg.
Take it, my friend.
Anyway, I'd had a great time in Berlin, but when I heard the magic words of Hollywood, I thought, well, that's really where I wanted to be all along. So then again, just like the way I left for Berlin, I left for Hollywood within about 3 days of speaking to Bob. I've known Bob for a long, long time. I mean, we used to meet in the weirdest places. I mean, first time I met him was in a really slick cocktail bar in a very posh hotel in Paris. I didn't even know who it was. It was just
George Sanker, one of them.
Yeah, I was there with Jethro, and we were just probably playing somewhere in Paris. And I was just sitting around in the cocktail bar on my own because nobody else in that band was interested in drinking or doing anything except for sitting in hotel rooms and watching TV. That was me this afternoon, just sitting there drinking something or other, probably Pernod. And there's a really weird-looking fella sitting in the other corner, which turned out to be Bob. You know, it's one of the places that's full of slick millionaires, or people who think they are, which, you know, Paris is very full of people like that. I'm pretty sure from the number of them that most of them aren't really millionaires, but they like to pretend that they are. Just this whole place full of that kind of people. There's me in one corner, then Robert looking very strange in another corner, and just natural gravitational attraction, we ended up sitting together. I mean, it's like the two outcasts from this one place.
Yeah, and it was definitely outcast. You'd be outcast from the one, the like the would-be millionaires, and there's also outcast from the other, the rock and roll thing. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like the hippies, I was never a hippie on one hand, and I was never a would-be millionaire on the other hand.
Oh, I am
so
now. I'm a would-be. I don't play it being one, but I'm a would-be if I had the chance.
A would-be.
Anyway, that's how I got to know Bob.
Well,
and when he said, oh, we'll come to L.A., I thought, well, it sounds like fun. Then he said a trio, which really appealed to me. Because in spite of all the strange and different things I've done, I always wanted to be a basic rock and roller. I never really had the opportunity before, though. Like with Jethro, I mean, Jethro started as a real blues band, and that was really, I really enjoyed it. And then, almost without me realizing, within about 2 or 3 years, it was probably the furthest thing removed from a blues band that ever existed. It's just that the whole thing turned round, and while I was in it, I didn't even notice that it was turning round. Then I got to a point when I thought, wow, is this the same band? I mean, I was enjoying it. I had a good time. What else can I say? What else do you
want
to
know? Yeah, I used to love Jethro when they were, you know, straight ahead. I mean, remember when I first saw you guys at the Hullabaloo in L.A., this place. Then it became the Aquarius Theater and became, it was all kinds of different things. But it was just straight ahead, and Ian was falling all over the place, and you were falling all over the place. Then they became very
still
busy.
Fall all over the place.
You know, they became very what, and I'm, you know, I'm not putting anybody down, but sometimes unschooled musicians' conception of what higher toned music is, you know, to change things very rapidly, bits, you know. But I mean, they have the idea that, you know, let's see, well, rock and roll is a little bit too common, so we'll orient ourselves to more classical modes, which they interpret as being a bit here, a bit there, a bit there. And if they would ever sit down and listen to any of the actual so-called classical composers who are only revered because they are old, you know what I mean? Old things, it's like the Andy Warhol syndrome, you know, I mean, you know, Coca-Cola bottle from 1910 is an objet d'art. It was actually, you know, it was what was current at that time. They were just the pop musicians of their time, except they were patronized by the wealthy because there was no mass market. But those guys wrote, you know, very long and sometimes even got into grooves. I mean, if you listen to any of the actual older things, the so-called classical things, they are not a series of bits strung together at all. There are themes that are repeated endlessly. And just because they're not in blues modalities, sometimes, you know what I mean?
Not just because they're not straight 4-4
yeah.
or bang on the bass drum.
Right, but they are very repetitive.
Yeah, the big difference between what the complicated things people do now, thinking that they are copying classical form and real classical stuff, is that any classical piece will take one theme and it will modify the theme and it will play variations on it, but it's all based around one thing.
Yeah.
Whereas now people just string together clever little ideas which don't really relate to each other.
Yeah.
And they've missed the point there.
Yeah, because that started to happen long about, you know, it was Stravinsky and all those people when they started to do, it was experimental. They were looking for a 12-tone scale, and the only people that pull that off, I think, are Pink Floyd. You know, simple.
Who are very, very simple.
Yeah, but they start a theme, and they can play for 18 minutes, and at the end of the 18 minutes, it's going crazy, whatever, a lot of things come, but the same theme has, like, modulated 10 different ways, but the same theme, you know, it's going up and down, it starts high and ends low, then it starts low and ends high, whatever, but the same theme is throughout, so the thing has a feeling of wholeness, you know? You know what I mean? It's not just tweedly, tweedly, tweedly. A lot of jazz guys who, like, stop playing formats, you know, the free jazz thing. They're trying for the same thing, you know, clusters. It's just, I don't know. Leaves me flat.
What surprised me about psychedelic music was...
I'm saying somebody else doesn't like it.
Around about 67, everybody was trying to do really freaky sound things as opposed to actual musical forms. They're trying to create sounds which gave off impressions. And then you listen to something like Stravinsky, The Rite of Spring, which he wrote in about 1901 or something, and he does that. I mean, he does that 10 times as well as anybody since has done it.
Sure.
Yet in 67, that was considered such a new form. We're just working with sounds. We're trying to create the impression of things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody thought it was so good and so new and such a modern thing. But, you know... 60, 70 years before, Stravinsky had done it, and he'd done it so well that, I mean, nobody
I must blurt out that French saying, which, you know, it's maybe this is a cliché, but, you know, when I say, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, you know what that is. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And that's not me saying, I think it was Louis XIV and Cardinal Richelieu who said that, which is very true. You know, really, it changes in quantity or in packaging, but I mean, it cannot be. There's only 12 notes, or if you break it down, if you want to use quarter tones, there are only
24.
Whatever the human ear can hear, and if you want to go beyond that and go into really different forms, you have to become something other than human, or have a hearing system, just for music, which can perceive things other than the basic 12 or 24 tones. I don't think there's any race of people on Earth that can hear more than 24 tones discreetly. I don't think there are people who can hear eighth tones. If there are, we probably can't see them. You know what I mean?
Right.
Frequencies.
Right. Yeah.
So, anyway, what we are is a basic rock and roll band that's not basic. You know, whatever that means.
Most of your tunes are short. Pretty concise.
Yeah.
Say, for most under 5 minutes.
Yeah, there's one.
Yeah, there's one longer.
But there's no reason to have, like Glenn was just saying, there's no reason to have a long thing for me unless you come up with a long thing that really holds up, you know, that really develops and builds. I mean, the idea of doing, you could do a 16-minute thing where you play it and then you go and everybody does a solo. But, you know, why do a solo unless you can build upon, as some of the old jazz guys used to do, and I used to hear, you know, not Coltrane, but somebody more straight ahead than that, I'm trying to think, you know. Even
I hate to hear the kind of solos that people do now, like five minutes of their best licks.
Yeah, it's just strung. We're not putting people down. Again, it's just where we're at this point. You know, maybe having heard a lot of stuff over a long period of year, it is, you just string together this lick and that lick, and I'm not saying I haven't.
That was real good when all those licks weren't cliches, but there's so few people around now who aren't just playing cliches. I mean, listen to most guitar solos on records, and most of them are just unnecessary. The only thing that they really do to the song is they change the tone of the song for two choruses. I mean, they don't create anything.
You know what it is?
They don't add anything musically.
Sort of, and if you relate it to films, it's like the difference between some of the older directors, you know, John Ford or even Antonioni, who does, you know, he flops at it sometimes, and the modern directors, many of whom have come out of television, which, you know, Antonioni and John Ford, they use the long shot. I mean, you've seen Antonioni movie, you know, like a recent one, the one with Jack Nicholson, where one shot, they'll do one actual shot and one actual take where the actors have to perform and the camera, it's a continuous piece of film with no editing for 5 minutes that builds of its own. As opposed to the television type of directing, where you get all these exploitation movies, The French Connection, that type of thing, where it's jump cuts, and what they do is they shoot the scenes and then they go in the editing room and edit the thing down. It's easy to build tension by jump cutting, you know, by slam to a close up, then slam to a thing, blood running out, then the gun in the hand, then the chain, then the car going off the cliff, but that, in a way, is a cop-out, and if you do it musically, you know, it's the same thing. You know, 30 seconds of this, then chunk, 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 then into another thing, then into another bit, then into another bit, then into another thing. Totally unrelated. You can create an artificial tension that way.
Shock treatment.
Shock. But I don't want to do that. I'm not saying it's bad, but I just don't want to do that. I know you don't want to do it. Hunt doesn't want to do it. Because I don't know, it just doesn't flow. I don't like to watch that. I don't like to watch those TV shows for that reason. It's so predictable, you know, like The Exorcist. Of course, you can create a very dramatic effect if you have a jump cut from a woman sitting in a chair, you know, looking up at a candle, and then immediate, you know, end to end cut of, you know, a girl vomiting, and simultaneous with the fact that the soundtrack goes up 10 dB. You've got to shock people. It's easy to startle people that way. You know, it would be very easy. I always thought to me at a gig, you know, at the end of the show for the big climax, instead of the smoke pots, what you do is you could have like a couple hundred pounds of raw liver, finely ground, suspended in plastic bags above the audience. And at the end of the show, you set off a smoke bomb, guy pulls a chain, and all this raw meat drops in the audience. And you have some beef hearts and some blood. Oh, that would be truly shocking, you know. But, I mean, you can shock yourself that way anytime you want to, you know. Just have somebody, you know, tell people, come up to me when I don't expect it, you know, and hit me across the face with a sausage. You know what I mean? It's easy to, that kind of juxtaposition, because of the techniques that are available today, both in films and recording, where you can edit and compose in the editing room, which is done in films and is done more and more in records, is I don't like that. I don't like to do it that way. I like to, you know, I used to go see an old jazz, you know, I'd go see Thelonious Monk and Charlie Rouse, and they would get in and play, and they would build for 25 minutes, solo after solo, but it would really build. I mean, each chorus the guy took would top the one after that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a real thing. It wasn't just, they didn't press a button and the lights change and a smoke bomb go off and suddenly the synthesizer comes in. Of course it's going to blow your head off. It has to. Because it's, you know, it requires an immediate adjustment in all your visual, oral, and possibly even anal perceptions. You know, oral, not oral, O-R-A-U-R, you know? And I would be jiving myself to do that. You know, I've played in bands like that before. I don't know. Not to say that people who do it, you know, aren't some people like them. That's fine. I'm not saying everybody should like what we like, but we're just telling you what we like, you know? Mm-hmm. Not putting anything down, you know? The same as, I don't know. And sometimes it works, like in when Monty Python show, which is basically done, a lot of the impact of it is done by editing. You know, if they had to stand up and do 10 minutes of nonstop rap and make it work with no editing, with camp, they could probably make it work, but they have chosen the format, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Using
for sure.
Bits and then cutting them short, and the juxtaposition of the various bits sometimes.
Juxtaposing really irrelevant things together.
That makes it fun. Well, that's one place where it does work, so I'm not saying it doesn't work some of the time, but others, much of the time it doesn't work, and I just don't want to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, with me, I just don't want to play the kind of music on stage where I've got to be standing there thinking about how many bars I've got to play before I change into the next thing. I like to be able to play something where I can get taken up with the flow of what I'm playing, and any changes that come in it will come naturally because they fit in not an obvious position, but they relate to the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I've played the complicated things before, and I was just sitting there thinking, when's it going to change? And I've got to keep my ears open to listen for the cues. And you're so tied up in playing the thing right, you know, without dropping any bum notes anywhere, that it's very difficult to put anything more than right notes into it. You know, to put any kind of expression, any kind of feeling into it. Maybe some people can do,
especially
but,
live,
but I certainly can't. I mean, I just get so taken up in what I'm doing that I tend to be blind to anything that's going on around me. I like to be like that.
I have to try to get in a groove.
I like
to
do it naturally, without it being a great concentration thing.
In a real groove.
Yeah.
Yeah. The old James Brown, how the old James Brown show used to be, whether or not you ever, you know, the old, oh, I mean, I'm old, I mean, 63, 64. I mean, he would say, you know, you got to feel it about 600 times. But every time he said it, now this is when he was really cooking, he's an old man now. Many people who are, you know, if you're 16 years old right today, I mean, you wouldn't have seen that because you would have been 5 years old then, you know. And there were very few five-year-olds that used to go see James Brown. But, I mean, he used to, every time he said it, when he was hot, it used to be hot, better than the time before.
Yeah.
Some kind of way, it was. And it almost got mantric, you know, mantra, you know what I mean? In that way. It was sort of like, if you've ever been to a real Baptist church in a black area of town where they're really still doing, they got the organ, the bass, the drums. They do that, and it builds. I mean, it's the real root of all that now has turned into soul or funk or whatever the thing, but it's jumped.